get worse and worse and worse. So I'm going to pick up from where the pilgrims take off from England and Holland. When the pilgrim separatists first joined together in England, they had committed themselves to walk in all the Lord's ways, made known or to be known, made known to them, according to their best endeavors, whatsoever it should cost them, the Lord assisting. And William Bradford noted in his history of the pilgrims that it cost them something, this ensuing history will declare. Few people had an easy life in the 17th century. By any standard, anyone there probably would have a harder lot than we do. But the pilgrims had an especially hard lot because they sought something better than their condition in England and in Holland, as already has been said. They were willing to undergo physical hardship, danger, and death to find a better future for their community and their children, and to serve, as they said, as a stepping stone in the advance of Christ's kingdom. Now, the day before they left Holland, as they had made some preparations to leave, their pastor, John Robinson, who was going to stay behind with some of the pilgrims in Holland, led them in a day of prayer and fasting. He preached on a text from Ezra, which said, "And there at the river by Ahava, I proclaimed a fast that we might humble ourselves before the Lord and seek of him a right way for us and for our children and for our substance." And that was with the exiles returning back to Israel was its original context, but a fitting passage for those about to leave and seeking God's help. They did not sleep much that night, but spent it all talking to their friends that they were about to leave in Holland. Bradford then recounts the scene of their departure the next day. He said, "The next day, the wind being fair, they went aboard, and their friends with them, were truly a doleful sight was the sad sight of that sad and mournful parting, to see what sighs and sobs and prayers did sound amongst them, what tears did gush from every eye, and pithy speeches pierced every heart. That sundry of the Dutch strangers that stood on the quay as spectators could not refrain from tears. Yet comfortable and sweet it was to see such lively and true expressions of dear and unfeigned love. But the tide, which stays for no man, calling them away, that were thus loath to depart, their reverend pastor falling down on his knees, and they all with him, with watery cheeks, commended them with most fervent prayers to the Lord and his blessing. And then with mutual embraces and many prayers, they took their leave one of another, which proved to be the last leave to many of them." Was a very dramatic and important and sorrowful scene, and yet one that showed how much the pilgrims loved one another. The pilgrims had purchased a small ship for their own use. They were going to use it to fish when they got to the New World, and its name was the Speedwell, and they hired another ship just to help them get across. But they went on the Speedwell to England. They were going to meet up with some of their financial investors, and then they were also going to take on some additional Englishmen that were going to join them in settling the New World. Not just Englishmen, but women and children. Some of them probably had Puritan sympathies, but they were not all members of the Puritan Church, and there were a few troublemakers among them. They left England with what we might call a good Midwestern goodbye, which is to say it took them a long time to leave. They left, and then the Speedwell was not doing well. It was leaking, so they had to put back in harbor at Dartmouth. And then they spent 9 or 10 days, and they thought the Speedwell had been fixed, and then they set off again. But then it continued to leak, and famously did not speed well. And then they turned around and had to come back to England, to Plymouth, Plymouth, England, that is. And so they ended up setting out for the final time, leaving behind the boat that they had purchased, the Speedwell, going off with this hired boat with a little bit less people than they had initially hoped. A month later, going into worse weather than had been anticipated, after they had already gotten seasick on the 1 month that they had been sailing and trying to leave. They'd even met on that last trip to Plymouth, I believe, one of those stops. They even met with John Smith, Captain John Smith, who had been to Jamestown, and who warned them of the many dangers that they would encounter. Of course, he had had experience where they almost all died, and unfortunately didn't. But finally, on the 6th of September, they sailed out of Plymouth on the Mayflower with the crew and 102 passengers, 28 of which were children. It was men, women, and children on this expedition. For the next 2 months, they would sail over the North Atlantic in rather tight quarters. It was often wet, and many of them got seasick because none of these passengers were sailors. They were farmers or craftsmen. One of the soldiers was rather, sailors was rather profane and enjoyed kind of making fun of the pilgrims and cursing them and saying he hoped to cast half of them overboard before their journey's end and to make merry with what they had. Not very encouraging words. But before the journey was half done, that young sailor fell ill and died, as Bradford says, in a desperate manner. And thus, not only the pilgrims, but the sailors, everyone on board, realized that his curses had come upon his own head by the just hand of God. Only one other person died on the voyage. I say only because some voyages during this time ended with all of theirs death. But this time, just one other, a servant to Samuel Fuller. Overall, the voyage was better than it could have been. The Mayflower had been a merchant ship carrying cargo, including wine, beforehand. And the wine had leaked out and had made the ship smell a lot better than it would have, and disinfecting some of the nasty smells that would have been on board that ship. Also, on that voyage, a baby was born safely to Stephen and Mary Hopkins, fittingly named Oceanus. There was also a time where a young man, John Howland, fell overboard during the midst of a storm. And it's rather difficult to catch someone when it's in the midst of a storm and wind. And he happened to grab hold of a loose rope that was trailing behind the ship, a rope that wasn't supposed to be loose. In fact, the guy who had left it loose later got flogged for it because it wasn't supposed to be loose. But he, John Howland, was able to catch it. He was able to get pulled back onto the ship. And he later got married and had 10 children. And a lot of the Mayflower descendants are from him. And so a very important event. When they were about halfway over, the main beam on the ship started to crack because of the strain on the masts, and serious discussion occurred whether they should proceed or not. But they had a large iron screw laying around by God's providence, were able to shore up that beam, and they decided to be careful about putting too much mast up, too much sail, and as Bradford says, they committed themselves to the will of God and resolved to proceed. Finally, 2 months later, land was sighted. It was November 9th. It was a joyful occasion because they had sighted land, but there was much to meet them. It was cold. It was bad weather. If you've noticed, November does not always have nice weather, not only in Missouri, but in New England especially. And they had no cheery welcome either. They didn't know what type of welcome they would receive. And it wasn't the land that they had headed for. They had designed to land in Northern Virginia, which at that point went rather far north. And what they indicate they were headed for was near where New York City is today, near the Hudson River. But they ended up on Cape Cod, and the shoals were so dangerous as they tried to go south, they decided that was not going to work, and they needed to go to New England instead. And when the decision was made, they knew that this would be outside the original jurisdiction they had. They wouldn't have a proper government in this land outside of Virginia. And so they made their own through what became known as the Mayflower Compact. Based on their church covenants, when they had formed themselves as a society, as a church, they covenanted together, pledged their allegiance to one another in mutual submission. So they did now as a civil community with the signing of the Mayflower Compact by almost every man in the community representing the whole. Notably, it declares their purpose in that voyage was for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith and the honor of our king and country. It's interesting, the last part, one of the ways the pilgrims were able to enjoy more freedom was to do something profitable for their country so that their king would be like, okay, it's all right if they have some freedom. They're doing something profitable for us. They made themselves useful, but they also did it for the advancement of the Christian faith. Well, they sent out a couple expeditions to scout out the next the territory that they had landed in. They sent three expeditions in the midst of winter weather, or late fall, in Cape Cod. They found corn in abandoned villages. They took the corn because they couldn't find its owners, but as soon as they could, decided to pay them back. And providentially, that would be their seed for the next year, or else we, instead of the first Thanksgiving, we might have heard of the first famine, the first starvation, and we maybe wouldn't have heard of Plymouth. On the third expedition, they were attacked by a band of native warriors, and that was their welcome. Hail of arrows that providentially hit none of them. They were able to get back into their shallop. Actually, there was a skirmish, and continued sailing, and on that same expedition found Plymouth Harbor. And so on December 16th, a month after they had arrived, 3 months after they had left England, they finally arrive in Plymouth Harbor. And do they all go on board, on land, and start living on land? No, there's nothing built on land. They continue to live on the ship. And on December 25th, because the pilgrims didn't celebrate Christmas, or at least those who are of the Separatist Church, that's when they began building their common house, their first main house to start. And so while the men explored the land and began to build their common house, most of them remained aboard on ship, and the conditions got worse and worse. As William Bradford remarks, "But that which was most sad and lamentable was that in 2 or 3 months' time, half of their company died, especially in January and February. Being the depth of winter, and wanting houses and other comforts, being infected with the scurvy and other diseases, which this long voyage and their incommodate condition had brought upon them, so as there died sometimes 2 or 3 in a day in the aforesaid time, that of 100 and odd persons, scarce 50 remained." During this time, sometimes there were only 6 or 7 people who were well enough to care for everybody else. Now, you know, might know how hard it is sometimes if someone in your family is sick to care for 1 or 2 or 3 people, maybe, or 4, if you're sick and you have to do it. Now, imagine you're in the 17th century and all that's required to keep the fires heated and get your food cooked. And then imagine that you're not just doing it for your family, but for a colony, what initially is 100 people and the crew. And those 6 or 7 people had to do, as Bradford describes it, all the homely and necessary offices for them, which dainty and queasy stomachs cannot endure to hear named, and all this willingly and cheerfully, without grudging any in the least, showing here and there true love unto their friends and brethren. 2 of those 7, by God's providence, were Elder William Brewster, their church leader that was with them, and Miles Standish, their military commander. And those were 2 of the few people that were well enough to be, you know, dressing and undressing and cleaning up after people, and those things that dainty stomachs cannot hear mentioned, who took care of the dying, of the sick, literally washing the feet of those whom they served, preparing them for what was to come. This contrasted with the way the sailors treated one another. Bradford remarks that the sailors were afraid of the sickness and so would abandon their fellows as soon as one got sick. As the pilgrims helped nurse one of the sailors who had cursed them and had made fun of them, and now he was sick and the pilgrims helped him, he would remark, "Oh, you, I now see, show your love like Christians indeed, one to another, but we let one another lie and die like dogs." And so there was a visible contrast in their actions, in their response to the crisis. But on shore, you might think maybe that was better. People on the ship were suffering. Well, there were 2 men, Peter Brown, John Goodman, went out to gather some thatching for roofing, and went out with 2 dogs. Didn't know the pilgrims had dogs. They had a mastiff and a spaniel. And the dogs chased a deer, and the men followed the dogs who followed the deer. And eventually they got lost in a frozen and wet wilderness and had to stay up all night in the fear of what they thought were lions. Turns out they were wolves, but they're still dangerous and still terrifying. And the next day they wandered until they saw the sea and arrived at that night, being faint and starving. And Goodman had to cut his shoes off because his feet were so swelled with cold. But they eventually got back to the Plymouth settlement. And the day after they arrived, the people on the board were awoken with seeing the common house that was finally built on fire. And it had caught fire, and they were anxious to see if they had been attacked. But they found out that the thatching, maybe that thatching that the 2 men were out trying to find, had caught fire by a spark and had burned up. But by God's mercy, none of the gunpowder had blown up, which was stored inside the common house. And two people, their current governor and their future governor, who were sick inside it, had been taken out and were unharmed. Just think of the odds. It was also by the providence of God that during this time, they were not attacked by the native peoples that surrounded them. They were weak and fragile and vulnerable. Just 2 years earlier, a Mr. Dermer and his men had landed nearby and were taken prisoners and escaped death only by overpowering some of their captors and holding them prisoners as hostages until they were let go. Earlier, a Mr. Hunt had stolen some of the natives and sold them into slavery in Spain. In 1617, a French ship had been shipwrecked, and the crew were massacred, except for three or four, who were treated worse than slaves. The pilgrims later found out that some of the natives thought that the pilgrims had come back for revenge, and were coming back to wreak havoc. And so you would expect them to then have attacked the pilgrims. But by God's providence, they refrained. One of the main reasons was that the disease had wiped out the inhabitants who lived near Plymouth. There was land that had been vacant due to the sad occurrence of a plague, which had wiped out a whole village. And the tribes around them had been weakened, were now threatened by larger tribes that were beyond them. Also, there's a story, perhaps it's legendary, perhaps it's accurate. It was recorded by Cotton Mather, and he says that the natives later told the settlers that when the English first arrived, that they had held 3 days of ceremonies where their religious leaders tried to curse the new settlers, to try to oppose them. But the spirits, of course the pilgrims interpreted to be devils, confessed that they could not hinder the newcomers, and this convinced the native peoples to deal kindly with them. Whether that's the case or not, in one way or another, it was clear that God orchestrated events to give the pilgrims an uncommonly peaceful arrival and settlement during that vulnerable time. But the pilgrims didn't know that at the time. They were sick. They were dying. They knew that they could be attacked. They had to hide the graves. They had to hide the fact that they were suffering in case there were any scouts in the woods. They left the graves unmarked. They couldn't show how weak they were. And I'm going to let Jeff take up the happy part of this story, and I'll leave you there. But what can we learn from such a time of suffering in the pilgrims' lives? Well, first, even in difficult and sorrowful times, there were many things to be thankful for. God's providential guidance of history was evident, not just his guidance over all history, but especially his particular care for those who called upon him, protecting them from worse disaster. The pilgrims quietly trusted God and resolved to proceed, and their trust was well placed. They knew that God was sovereign even over their suffering, and they did not rebel against him during this hardship. They knew they were pilgrims. They were looking to something better. They looked to a higher reward than ease and affluence. If they were faithful and loving, and if their children had a promising future, it was enough. They took to the heart the words of the Apostle Paul, where he said, "Not that I am speaking of being in need, for I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me." By God's grace, they persevered. The sacrificial love of the pilgrims is another important point, an example to be followed. Sometimes we picture the pilgrims as grim, puritanical figures in black clothing that are just judgmental and stern, but nothing could be further from the truth. They held together even when this meant risk, even when this meant danger. They served each other humbly, even their leaders, even the sometimes flamboyant Miles Standish. It is noted that the children, you think if there's a plague, if there's sickness, if there's weakness, you expect maybe the weaker ones, like the children, to suffer the most. But actually the children had one of the higher survival rates. In fact, the girls had one of the higher survival rates. And they, some historians say this is probably because the parents were giving their food to their children. They knew that there was going to be a future for that community. It is truly remarkable that when the Mayflower left to go back to England, not one of the settlers chose to go back They all decided to remain with each other there, stranded on the other side of the Atlantic. They were bound together by God's covenant and by their civil covenant. They held together even when they had been reduced to a fragile group of 50 people in the midst of a vast wilderness. Faith, contentment, and love. These held this band together through the hard times. They kept their eyes on the goal and on each other rather than their fears and their sufferings. Later, leaders in New England would realize that this religious faith had brought their colonies to prosperity, but this prosperity might easily threaten their society, more so than the suffering did in those early years. Cotton Mather, a later Puritan figure in New England, said that religion hath brought forth prosperity, and the daughter destroyed the mother. There is a danger, lest the enchantments of this world make them forget their errand into the wilderness, make them forget their purpose for coming. How much more is that sentiment true today? May we remember the sacrifices our forefathers made to give us a foundation. Let us not enjoy the prosperity in a way that we forget their vision for a free and loving society dedicated to walking in all the Lord's ways to the best of our endeavors, whatever it may cost us. Thank you.